And that's the kicky music that means it's time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. And if your minds have not already been blown by the appearance of a different voice...
Linda Holmes, you have a frog in your throat.
Let me say up front that Linda Holmes is seeing movies and not appearing on our podcast this week. And it is the feeblest excuse this side of dogs eating homework.
But, we blame the AFI and the Silver Docks Festival.
The lure of Silver Docks was too great for Ms. Holmes to resist.
Who needs Gladys Knight? This is an all Pips episode.
No, it's not.
There are so many Pips in this episode.
We're the worst orange juice ever.
As you might be able to tell, we have a guest voice and a familiar one at that. TWB, please introduce yourself to the nice people.
I'm in the house. This is Tanya Ballard Brown.
From?
NPR.org.
From the news. From the serious, obviously.
Digital news.
From the serious side of things, as you can tell.
We like to refer to her, the lady who knows where China is.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Over there somewhere.
So we've got the TWB in place of the LAH.
Okay.
Trey
Graham. No, you should just make her the Lady Holmes.
The Lady Holmes.
There you go.
TWB is my club name. My rap one.
I need a club name. Before this episode is over, I expect a club name. Trey Graham, please introduce yourself.
I am T to the G, and I...
Please. Oh, please.
Wow. You know, Linda Holmes takes one episode off, and we just fly off the rails and into a crevasse.
It's true. I edit movies coverage for NPR.org.
Mr. Weldon.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write about books and comic books for the NPR website, and my club name is Sandwich.
Okay.
Is there a gorge at the bottom of the crevasse? So, no Linda Holmes. So we've got guests galore because we are not done.
We are not done with the guests.
Flipping
Switching
the proverbial script as if we have
surprises
one.
Surprises for you.
We do not have a script, but we do have an agenda.
We have.
And the first item on the agenda is the Green Lantern.
We are going to talk about the Green Lantern.
Because we have not talked enough about superhero movies.
Or big summer blockbusters.
Right, or big summer blockbusters. Here's where we start blowing a few minds here, okay? Though the Green Lantern is actually somewhat near and dear to my heart, Martin O'Dell, who created the Green Lantern, was a dear friend of my family growing up, a wonderful, kind man. I have not seen the movie.
Don't hold on to your dreams.
Here's the thing. I wanted to support the memory of the lovely Mr. Martin O'Dell by seeing the Green Lantern, but then I thought it looked awful. And so I didn't see it. I'm sitting at a table and in a room full of Green Lantern viewers.
That is true.
So I'm going to recuse myself from this conversation.
Yep.
I'm going to bring in a guest. I'm going to step out. I'm going to deploy the emergency catsif. Mike Catsif, please take my microphone.
And now that the catsif is in his chair, I, in my role as movies editor, am going to try to steer this conversation, herd this particular batch of Green Lantern watching cats. Glenn Weldon, you reviewed the movie for NPR.org at my assignment, at my instruction, at my orders. Tell me, bottom line, is it, as Stephen Thompson suspects, a terrible movie?
It is a hugely disappointing movie, if you come at it from a perspective of a fan of the books and a fan of this particular character.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with this character. I grew up loving this character. The lore of this character is something I internalized as a kid. To me, it feels very real.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing it...
Wait, what sector of the universe do we live in?
We live in Sector 2814. Uh-huh. Duh. Mm-hmm. Seeing it brought to life... but not deepened in any way, not enriched, just blown up for the big screen, makes it seem silly and thin and flimsy. And the word I came down to is hokey. Mm. And that's a very disappointing
thing. It was very, very hokey.
Hokey is a good word.
Tanya Ballard Brown, you saw the movie, and I take it you were not charmed by it.
I knew this movie was going to be terrible before Ryan Reynolds even showed up on the screen. It looked like Wrath of the Khan from 19... I said if Ricardo Montalban shows up with some leather and a wig on, I would not be surprised. DC Comics, what did they... Marvel, pay attention. Pay attention to what Marvel has done.
I had a bad feeling from the opening 45 seconds of background narration.
Right.
And the movie never really pulled itself out of that hole for me. Mike Katziff, what do you think?
I would totally agree. I think even from that narration, I started laughing, and that's kind of a bad sign. Yeah. I think Tanya's right, though. I mean, Marvel has done it really well, and even with something as gigantic and epic as even Thor, which is a character that very few people know about and is just as epic and has just as much exposition that you sort of have to set up, they still figured out a way to boil it down.
Yes.
And this movie, from the get-go, was confusing. The imagery on the screen was confusing to even look at. I was having a hard time even seeing what the action was because, you know, well, we also saw it all in 3D, I assume.
I didn't.
Good for you.
We were forced to see it in 3D, and, you know, from the get-go, it was just very cartoony and just hard to see what anything was, and so you're already trying to figure out where am I and what is this even about.
I had some real problems with the internal logic of the film. I don't understand why Ryan Reynolds, the central Green Lantern character, gets to travel through the galaxy in a bubble of green energy, but the guy who turns him into the Green Lantern needs a spaceship to travel.
That is a question that's been asked for years because that's part of the original Silver Age origin. A crucial difference in the Silver Age origin, we don't know anything about the Guardians of the Universe. All we see is
these are the guys with the big heads who sit on top of the circle of ice cream scoops.
Yes, these are the Smurfs.
The Smurfs on the scoops
in choir robes.
Yes,
they. We are introduced to that whole world through his eyes. We don't see it beforehand. He finds the alien and he goes up, and it's a process of discovery, a process which would have worked really well in a movie.
For instance, a movie where people who had never encountered these characters before could discover them in the same way.
Yeah.
But instead, you got 45 seconds of narration about the history of the universe, and you got to see the villain before you got to see the hero.
Right, absolutely.
And then the villain looked like the Halloween, those things that you put on your house.
It looked like...
I'm sorry.
The villain was so disappointing that Tanya is speechless.
Yes.
It was just, no.
Also, she's banging her phone on the table.
The makeup was, I just do not understand why this movie looked like it was filmed in 1982.
That's a good point.
The sets, going back to Thor.
There were some visual shout-outs to specific movies. The terrace sequence is a clear sort of homage to the Superman, the original Superman movie. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things about this movie that I liked. The sidekick characters, Fish Sauce and Pork Chop. I was a fan of Fish Sauce and Pork Chop.
What are their real names? Glenn?
Fish Sauce and Pork Chop.
Yeah.
Oh, Tomar Ray and Kilowog. Fish Sauce and Pork Chop.
Samuel.
Dude is a gigantic talking fish in a green suit.
Okay.
Whatever.
Okay.
I do appreciate, as I have said to several people, that the filmmakers go to such lengths to portray the physical agony Hal Jordan goes through. I mean, in the scene where he is abducted from Earth in a ball of green fire, taken across the galaxy and scanned by some alien technology while he's floating mostly naked in midair.
Yeah.
In this scene, it is very clear that he is in pain. And we know this because he cries out and he does some naked midair crunches. I mean, that is the point of the scene, right?
Yeah, that scene is going to increase the aftermarket value of this particular film in certain circles.
Oh, yes.
In, like, animated GIFs.
Certain circles. Meaning my house. But, yeah, I don't think, a lot of people trying to put the blame for why this movie went wrong on Ryan Reynolds' enormous shoulders.
Not fair at all, no.
There were so many other things not right with this movie.
Yeah. The script, production design, the direction.
There was no chemistry between him and Blake Lively at all. Mm-hmm. And how did she get in this movie?
you need one of those. I'm sort of joking, saying, you know you're in a bad movie when Blake Lively is the most interesting character out of all of it. She wasn't at all.
She wasn't. Mark Strong did a good job. Mark Strong as Sinestro conveyed a certain nobility. He looked silly, but, you know, the character looks silly.
It's hard to not look silly when you're painted pink.
Yeah. And it's more magenta, really.
It's interesting that you mention Sinestro because there's a little coda. That makes it very, very clear that they want this to be a franchise, as if we didn't know that anyway. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the box office take tells us about the prospects for that.
I mean, this movie cost a boatload of money. It was about $150 million, I read.
There were reports from there up, I think.
Yeah, and probably much more than that for marketing and stuff like that, and all of these tie-ins. Brought in about, 57 million?
53 is the figure I saw.
And, you know, the worldwide box office take for this will be much bigger. It, you know, it'll earn its money back. The question is whether it will earn enough to be a franchise that a studio can sort of eat off for
a decade. And 53 isn't a small amount of money to bring in for a weekend or anything like that, but compared to how much it cost. But when you look at how much it cost and then see what it actually
looks like.
It looked so much cheaper than $150 million went into making that movie. Like, the effects were just so...
It also made less money than Ghost Rider in its opening weekend. Now, Ghost Rider doesn't have exactly high name recognition. It does have Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
But
it had a motorcycle that was on
fire.
I
saw another. It made less than Daredevil, right?
Yeah.
To Glenn and to Tanya, who are readers of the comic books, what is it about DC characters that cannot be translated to the big screen?
The Batman
movies have been really successful.
Right, sorry.
Superman,
the Christopher Reeve Superman were successful.
There's something in like these gigantic cosmic operas like that that is not relatable in the way that
I'll tell you why. I think the DC Comics characters are all superheroes with fancy. Batman is the only man.
Mm-hmm.
He's a detective. And everybody else is somebody that can fly and do all these outrageous things. And more of the Marvel comics are like real people.
It's like grounded in a reality.
Right. Who fell in, got bitten by a spider.
Grounded in reality.
But, the gamma rays. Yeah. So there's a person with a life and a little bit of a storyline before. I mean, Hal Jordan could have been done better because he was one of the few who had a story, the fighter jet pilot.
Yeah, and as Glenn, I think, pointed out, the movie chooses not to begin its narrative with him. It starts on another planet, and I think you're right. There's a real missed opportunity there.
So we could have a DC versus Marvel throwdown here.
I'm not trying to do that at all.
That would be tedious for everybody. But, I mean, the classical distinction between these two universes is that DC characters are characters you aspire to be, and Marvel characters are characters you identify with. Stan Lee did that on purpose to allow pimply teenagers to identify with his characters.
All right, having completed that particular bit of very, very important business, I would like to kick Mike Katziff back to the producer's chair and bring Stephen Thompson back to the host's microphone. Over to you, sir.
All right, so while you guys were discussing Green Lantern, I actually slipped out to a nearby theater and saw it, and I loved it!
This is not true.
It was a Cracker Jack Rock'em Sock'em adventure with two thumbs way up! Wow. What'd you guys think of it?
Wow!
I'm just glad to introduce our next segment. And for this, we're going to mix it up yet again.
Oh, no.
We're going to boot the TBB.
I'm out.
Darn it, why does the black character always get killed first?
Now, Bob, I would imagine you're probably aware of why we've called you in here to discuss Company.
Because my name's Bobby.
Because your name is Bobby, and having listened to the last segment, it occurred to me, this podcast, not gay enough.
Well, we're going to go there with Company.
Yeah, we're totally going to go there with Company.
So we now have like 40% of NPR's gays seated around a table.
Stephen, could you leave again and let us bring Ari Shapiro in? Right. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you hadn't figured it out, Bob Mondello, our film critic, has stepped in for this segment.
Hoot! Yay!
Delightful to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you. We're just ever expanding the lovable menagerie of goofballs and nitwits who form the pop culture happy hour
and
team.
And I do qualify, although I don't always do it on ATC.
One of my concerns with having you in here, Bob, is that you have sort of qualifications to discuss the topic at hand.
I'm so sorry.
This is true. In addition to being a film critic, Bob is a longtime theater critic.
Although you can claim that too.
It's
so
true.
That's only fair.
But Trey is 5 years younger.
Oh, snap!
I don't even know which of us is insulted by that.
So the discussion at hand. Now, just to provide a little bit of background for dullards like myself. Mm. Company, big hit on Broadway.
Yeah, it was basically his first big hit that wasn't Funny Thing
him
Happened.
Being?
Sorry, Stephen Sondheim.
Okay. We're going dullard deep.
All right,
here.
Let's start at the beginning. It's Stephen Sondheim, and it is Stephen Sondheim doing a very eccentric musical. It isn't a plot musical. It's a musical that is a whole bunch of vignettes of this character named Bobby, who is having his 35th birthday, and you have a whole bunch of sequences with him and his married friends, because he's always the odd man out. The big song in that begins the second act is Side by Side by Side. And because he's always with his friends, but he's never sort of attached.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful piece of choreography that goes with that song, yeah, where everybody does a little couples dance. When it comes his turn, he doesn't have anybody to throw to. If you have seen this movie, that's probably one of the things you noticed.
I saw this in 1971 with Larry Kurt. Trey is always saying that I saw it before the flood.
I like to say everything. That Bob saw...
must have seen Showboat originally
Bob,
in Bob 1920
saw,
or
Bob
whatever.
Saw a company in the original Sanskrit.
But I saw it back in 1971. I saw it on Broadway a couple of years ago with, who was it, Raul?
Esparza.
Yes.
Raul Esparza.
And then I went up to...
in the stripped-down version with the people playing their own instruments.
I then saw it just a couple of months ago in New York with this cast on at the Avery Fisher Hall. And it was kind of cool to see it in the audience. It was, like, amazing.
Now, is
and this is one of the reasons we asked Bob to come in today, because not only does he have a history of the show, he actually saw this production in the theater live, the live version of what we all went to see this week filmed in our movie theaters.
And as starry as it seemed, you know, like, I mean, this had a lot of cool people. I just have to mention this. I sat down in my seat, and my husband said, don't look behind you. And so I listened for a couple of seconds, and I said, Sarah Jessica Parker and Matthew Broderick? And he nodded, and then he said, now look across the aisle. Sting? And it was like, and I hear Woody Allen, who was in that same audience somewhere. I didn't see him. He must have been on the other aisle. It was weird how star-studded this thing was.
Meanwhile, yeah. I saw Kung Fu Panda 2 next to a kid with the worst breath I've ever encountered. And that kid was Sting's son. No. Now, you say movie.
Yes, because we are talking about the filmed version of this Avery Fisher Hall concert production with the New York Philharmonic, which has been shown in movie theaters over the last couple of weeks and may still have a few performances to play by the time this podcast hits.
Yeah, they're talking about doing it again sometime in July because it was apparently very popular all over mm-hmm. the country. This is a benefit for the New York Philharmonic, and what was kind of cool about the show at Avery Fisher Hall is you have all these stars and they're performing on sort of the lip of the stage, but there's a 35-piece orchestra behind them, and you know,
much bigger than the show would ever get.
Enormously bigger. It's like twice the size of the orchestra for any Broadway musical these days.
So because it's filmed, they're pulling out all the stops for this particular performance. Mm-hmm.
There were four performances, and okay. as far as I know, they filmed them all. I can tell you for sure that the evening I saw it was not the evening that they showed of Patti LuPone doing Ladies Who Lunch, because she was spectacular in the film. I'm really spectacular, and there were a couple of vocal flaws when I saw it, and you thought, ooh, they're not going to let that stay.
Yeah.
But she was amazing in this.
We should talk about the fact that there was very little rehearsal time, famously little. They kind of talked about that a lot.
Well, apparently John Cryer got there from 2.5 minutes. I mean, didn't have anything else to do this last little bit. And he got there and apparently was expecting to, you know, be on reading it off of a music stand or something like that when he was performing, and then realized, oh, they want us to do choreography. I mean, they expected him to be on, you know, off book.
This was not a concert staging.
Not
this
at
was
all.
Very full.
Yeah, it was really pretty great. This could have run on Broadway for a nice long time, not because of the stars in it, but because it's just really cleverly done. Mm-hmm. But you'd never get these stars to do it on a regular basis. You can't get, I mean, Stephen Colbert doesn't have all that many evenings free. Yeah.
Now, Bob, you've seen it on the stage, obviously. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the translation to film?
Yeah, it's the first time in a long time that I've been in a movie theater with everybody applauding at the end of numbers.
See, that didn't happen in ours. Did you see it in downtown DC?
I saw it at the AFI.
Yeah.
Probably 400 people there, and it was a bunch of times. And Patti LuPone, there was long applause.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the advantage that there are people applauding on the soundtrack, so that
right.
it doesn't sound unreasonable.
Right.
But my audience was hooting and howling.
I have to say, I saw it the night before Bob did in the same space, and my audience was not quite as live. And I think this gets to something that may help us sort of broaden this conversation out to talk a little bit about, you know, more than just this one particular production. What is it like to watch a live event with that filter in between?
Right.
What does it add? What gifts does it give you? And what gets lost in translation? And to me, for my audience, I think that giving open response was part of what got dropped.
The electricity. Also, there is a certain cognitive dissonance that mm-hmm. descends. It took me about 5 minutes to conclude that they're not going to cut to a pledge break, because this does seem like very PBS-y fodder. This does seem like you're expecting the three tenors to come out any minute. It took me a while to get into it. I spent 3 years in the trenches as a theater critic here in D.C. I have never seen this show performed. Mm-hmm. I have listened to it, to the cast album, many, many times. I have seen Elaine Stritch at Liberty, where she does The Ladies Who Lunch. But there's something about that song that never occurred to me, that I never noticed, because A, I'm pretty dumb, but B, the clues to it are all in the book and not in the lyrics. So every time I've heard the song Ladies Who Lunch, I always saw it as a sort of omnidirectional, she's spraying bile all over the stage at these people she's judging. I never realized that the final verse, which begins, here's to the ones who just watch, was self-directed.
Right.
Yeah. Now, was self-lacerating. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the clues, she's drinking vodka stingers, she's one of these people who makes fun of people all the time. A lot of the clues aren't in the song itself that kind of lead you to that.
There's another, is at least one other major song from this show that works exactly the same way, and that's Another 100 People, which doesn't make any sense at all in the context that you usually hear it performed in, which is cabaret.
Right, that's true. Seeing Patti LuPone perform it in that particular performance that we saw in this movie was a revelation because she sold it.
Made
so that's
gay,
my
didn't it?
That's my insightful commentary. Patti LuPone is good at what she does. You can take that to the bank. I'm going to stand behind that.
You know, the sad thing is that's more than I'm bringing.
My God. Seriously, I was charmed by almost everyone in this production. Christina Hendricks is terrific doing this comedy that I don't think I knew that she was capable of, that kind of comedy. I knew that she was capable of a drier, wittier, more restrained kind of comedy. She's delightful in this. Mm-hmm. And we are all of us on record as being gigantic Neil Patrick Harris fans, right?
Sure.
All of us on this podcast.
No, he's amazing.
But when you get to the second act of this show, and Patti LuPone, who is an honest-to-God Broadway star for decades, pulls out an honest-to-God Broadway star voice and sings that song, it is like somebody has pinned your ears back and you know what the fuss is about.
Yep, that's totally fair. But we haven't said enough about Neil Patrick Harris. Mm. Neil Patrick Harris is amazing in the show. At the Tony Awards the last couple of years, he's done these incredible numbers that have just been exhilarating because he's performing them so well. Seeing him in the show, I thought, geez, he's good.
He can
act. Just really good.
He can actually
act. But seeing him on screen, and here's the big difference between, I was only in about the 12th or 13th row. I wasn't that far back. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't see all the subtle stuff he was doing with expressions. In this, it's a very subtle performance in a lot of places where you just think, just an arched eyebrow or something. It's amazing.
So that's actually something that we're gaining from watching this this film performance that you didn't have access to in the hall.
You can see a close-up of his expressions.
Right. I've heard people complaining about the fact that they sort of direct you where to look, which you don't have on a stage.
There was some intrusive camera work, to my taste.
Bob, you are a cinephile, obviously. You are obviously also a theaterophile.
What would that be? A dramaphile?
Dramaphile. I think we're all dramaphiles.
A drama nerd.
How do you feel about sort of taking one medium and grafting it into another? The way I think of this production, it's as if you decided that you needed sort of a bunch of like Louvre farm teams. And so you open a Louvre in Milwaukee with really nice photo prints of all the paintings that hang in the Louvre. And so you're walking around an art gallery in Milwaukee and it's supposed to be the Louvre. And you're getting the same images, but you're not getting the experience. Are you a purist in that way? Do you feel, as a theater person, like taking the theater experience, taking the Broadway experience, and trying to graft it into the movie theater at the Fox River Mall in Appleton, Wisconsin, that something is lost?
Sure, something's lost, but something's also gained if suddenly you have a front row seat instead of whatever seat you would have someplace else. That's kind of cool. Yeah, the electricity of live theater disappears in this format. Now, you could say that there are lots of other things that you get out of it. The quality of the sound in this with a 35-piece orchestra is very different. I've seen a bunch of things that I've thought have worked quite nicely that were from stage to film without turning it into Hello Dolly or something like that, with Barbara Streisand wandering around, so that you don't restage the whole thing and you don't do it with the real world supposedly being represented. A few years ago, Spike Lee took a show called Passing Strange, and he simply filmed four performances of it and turned it into a movie that made my top, I always cheat, so it wasn't actually the top 10, but within the top 20 of the year, it was spectacularly good with Stu, and it was just a really wonderful story. It's a stage-bound story, and it would have messed it up, actually, to turn it into a movie so that people were out in the world. But, you know, musicals it seems to me this is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. When they took Phantom of the Opera and they turned it into an allegedly fully cinematic thing, it was awful.
It was a gigantic disappointment.
It was terrible. So I think this is infinitely superior to that. So I think you can do this and it can work.
It's worth noting that this has been done successfully in a number of formats. I mean, Alan Bennett's Talking Heads are mm-hmm. plays that were made for television, right? And mm-hmm. they work very successfully both on stage and in television. It's not only theater that gets done in these big screen theater broadcasts. There are actual live events. There are concerts that get broadcast. I'm actually sort of interested in what happens in this kind of space when the event is actually live, like the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts. You know, that high wire act that is live performance, that gets retained when the event is live. And I frankly would love to see a performance go off the rails in a theater full of people where the sort of expectation about decorum is a little bit less than it is in the actual Metropolitan Opera House, where you could sort of giggle, if necessary, at the lady
at others' misfortunes.
At others' misfortunes. Wimbledon is being done in 3D.
Well, that's a really interesting point, actually, that you make about sports.
Yep.
That I think sports may be the next front, you know, I mean, obviously some of this stuff has been done already to a certain extent, but you already have, I think, a culture surrounding everybody getting together and watching a sporting mm-hmm. event unfold in a bar, yep. you know, in whatever. But if you had a IMAX screen and 3D cameras yep. and it's the Super Bowl and you don't
or
have
a boxing match
or a boxing match yeah. Or MMA or whatever mm-hmm. or the Indy 500 or whatever.
Ooh, people, I don't want to see that on a God, I'd barf.
That's true.
God, on IMAX screen.
Well, so you're expecting sports fans to go into a theater and sit in those seats and not get lots and lots of beer and
well, that's what oh, yeah. that's I what think chose that's what theaters that I serve beer are for.
I think there have to be different concession rules for the boxing
there
match.
Certainly do,
and it probably depends somewhat on the sporting event. If people, you know, something like the Super Bowl, where people are accustomed to it, you know, to talking to their friends during it, versus something like tennis, or you know, where watching the event involves sitting down and not necessarily.
Wait, you mean they're not going to be throwing their Pimm's cup at the screen at the Wimbledon 3D?
Oh God, golf on the screen. Oh, yeah.
Thwack.
They've done concerts for years, though.
Right.
I mean, it's no big deal to. I mean, Woodstock, the movie Woodstock, and things like that on screen. So they've had some very impressive directors, Martin Scorsese and people
sure.
like that, doing this kind of thing. So it's not as if live performance hasn't been captured on screen.
Well, one thing that I've always wondered, I mean, I always used to say, and I don't know if I would still say this, but I always used to say that if I could invest in one technology, it would be holograms.
Mm-hmm.
That a really cool holographic simulation of a concert, you know, where you could have U2 perform at a bar mm-hmm. for a $5 cover, and you see, like, Simu Bono, you know, up there preening around.
Well, you get to, that sort of gets to an interesting point, which is that I think the experience of these things is exactly as good as the amount invested in them.
Mm-hmm.
To bring it back to the topic we started with, Company was a little disappointing because I didn't actually think the sound was that great. The voices weren't present in the room in the way they would have been in a, you know, in a real concert hall. The orchestra wasn't overwhelming in the way a 35-piece orchestra really is. And this was in a, you know, this was in the AFI, a big theater with a fairly good sound system.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it maybe the production?
They didn't crank it up.
They didn't crank it up, and I don't think it was heavily mic'd. So, again, technology, I think the amount you invest in the filming and the production and the post-production of these things makes a great deal of difference to the experience. But, that said, personally, I wholeheartedly endorse both ways of consuming theater.
I think that pretty well sums it up. Theater, colon, good.
Yep.
Movies, colon, also good.
Yep.
Bob Mondello, you know, you're a pretty good guy yourself.
Aww,
thank you so
thanks,
much
guys.
For,
this,
for
this
coming in.
Thanks, Bob.
Just, I love that our universe just gets bigger and bigger.
And gayer and gayer.
And gayer and gayer. Now we'll bring back Tanya Ballard Brown. All right, so that brings us to our final segment of this installment of Pop Culture Happy Hour. What is making us happy? I am going to start, since it's been so long since she's spoken, with the TWB, Tanya Ballard Brown, what is making you happy this week?
I might get to keep my little Simon Doodle, my friend's dog, for like a week and a half. Yes, that's so exciting.
That is what is making you happy?
Yes, I don't have a pet.
Dogs.
What is making you happy is temporary TWB. Pet ownership.
Right. You know what's great about that? The temporary part.
They're like nephews.
You get a little rice.
They're exactly.
Get
you
your
give
love,
them back.
Go to your house.
Give them back when they're done.
Maybe the Humane Society should do rentals.
Yeah, I'd do that.
to actually, confuse and traumatize.
Actually, I hate to admit this about humanity, but I think that's a thing. I think there are places where you can rent a dog.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, I know.
So the dog gets all attached.
Where are they? Can you send me that information?
Actually, I believe that's a Tokyo thing.
There's Tokyo.
It is a Tokyo thing that you can rent a dog to help you de-stress.
Do they ship them?
This is the theory of a lot of lovable high maintenance things is that it's fun to have them for a while.
Don't listen to these people telling you they're cat people.
I'm a cat person too. I have a cat.
Fine.
Good. Cashmere and corduroy. I rehomed them.
Yes, Glenn is a dog person, and he just the only part he does not understand of what you've just said is the temporary.
No, I grew up with a lot of animals. I had cats, plural, dogs. Plural with a Z. since that's what that sounded like. I had gerbils, hamsters, guinea pigs. I had a parakeet.
I think it's impossible to say. I think it's impossible to say hamsters with a Z.
Sea monkeys.
They need a Z.
They do need a Z. So what is making you happy is the fleeting love of a dumb animal. Boy, have I known that. No. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Are you guys following Your Aunt Diane on Twitter?
No.
No.
You really should. It is a parody of a very specific kind of person. Here's her bio. I am a jewelry designer working on my art and myself. Come by my kiosk at Santa Fe Outlets. There's a 2-for-1 on Nepalese earrings. Here are some sample tweets. A crisis apparition just interrupted my algae bath to warn me about the alchemist I'm dating.
Okay.
But I just can't help loving danger and metals.
Okay.
Wow.
My favorite girls' names, if I could have children, Coriander, Forsythia, Breath, Tansy, Vishpala Lakshmibai, Tarragon, Thicket, Carly Simon.
Didn't Michael Jackson have a kid named Thicket?
I don't know.
No.
It's Blanket.
It's Blanket.
Sorry, Blanket.
Sorry.
And it's his nickname.
Okay.
Most masculine names rub me the wrong way, so my favorite boys' names are Whisper, Trinket, Feathers, and Ceremony. And the last one, the one that sums up everything about this particular Twitter character. Pouring Chardonnay up my nose with a neti pot.
Oh, my.
Your Aunt Diane, just like it sounds.
This
Twitter.
Is so not my Aunt Diane. My other half's Aunt Diane is a nice lady from Queens who works for the NYPD.
I don't
have that Aunt Diane.
She
does
should be on Twitter, though. I bet she has totally
Oh, did I mention she has a Keanu Reeves obsession? She should totally be on Twitter.
Though this particular handle does remind me of the great Gene Teasdale.
Yes, exactly,
If you follow Gene Teasdale, that's Teasdale with only two E's. Mm-hmm. My favorite Gene Teasdale tweet is, OMG, I slept through the royal wedding! And then she spends the entire day like trying to find out what it was like.
Two people got married.
That she spent weeks and weeks preparing for the royal wedding, and she's missed it.
So
Your Aunt Diane on Twitter, is that D-I-A-N-E?
It is.
Your Aunt Diane on Twitter, Trey Graham.
Sounds
what is
amazing.
Making you happy?
I must say that one particular subset of my people is making me unhappy this week. I am talking about you, Logo. You are not good for the gays. And I will talk about that more next week, I believe.
I am displeased. More next week.
Yeah.
But I am
pleased to say that there is one gay who is making up for it, and that gay is Chris Colfer, the actor from Glee. This is not a timely thing because I am behind on my Glee watching. I had stopped for a while after a string of episodes that felt, as Glenn Weldon might put it, a little epinasal. But last night, and I swear I am not making this up, I took a break from reading A New Civil War History to watch the Born This Way episode. And while I would not describe the episode as subtle, I was surprisingly taken by Kurt's big number, which is this.
I don't want to be alone. That's all in the past. This world's waited long enough.
Okay, so this is As If We Never Said Goodbye from Sunset Boulevard, a number.
This is the gayest podcast
exactly
ever! Oh my god!
I warned you.
Seriously, I'm gonna have to like watch the NBA draft or something just to like make.
Come on, we can. I might join you watching some sports.
Come on, we talked about Wimbledon.
No gays watch Wimbledon.
No, I think that, you know, say what you will I think it takes a particular kind of testicular fortitude. Mm-hmm. If you are a slight, if you are a slight, effeminate gay actor, to stand up on a network that people actually watch and sing a song written for a crazy lady silent movie star character. Mm-hmm. Not only did he do it, he made it work in the context of a storyline about a conflicted kid returning to a high school where he'd been bullied. And not only did he do that, he made it genuinely touching. I like this kid, and I'm going to give his show another chance.
Go, Chris Colfer. What is making Trey Graham happy?
That's right.
And what is making me happy?
Jazz hands.
Jazz hands.
Spirit fingers.
Tank tops.
Sequins.
Small dogs. No. I'm actually going to
nachos.
Go. I'm going to go back to a predictable old well and say that what is making me happy is the following tape. Mike, will you play my tape?
Hello, I'm Tom Hanks. Thank you. As an artist with a taste for excellence, I find it odd, truly odd, that The Onion has yet to be honored by whoever it is that awards the Pulitzer Prize. In fact, I'm angry. I feel an intense physical malice towards whoever is in this mysterious cabal of power brokers and so-called tastemakers who gather annually in what must be some all-night drunken bacchanalia slash pinata party, the result of which is the awarding of the prize Pulitzer. If our Onion does not receive this year's P2, I will search you down, each and every one of you who is responsible for this grave injustice. The Pulitzer Prize Committee, in fact, should be ashamed of making me feel this way. But I have spoken, and thank you.
What could make me happier than my beloved alma mater? Not technically alma mater. I used to work there.
You know what's making me happy is that Tom Hanks, who could afford every speech and vocal coach in the history of the planet, mispronounces Pulitzer.
Oh, is it? Oh, does he say Pulitzer?
He does.
That bastard. Well, and he's no longer making me happy. Mm. I actually was at The Onion the first time that we submitted our candidacy for a Pulitzer Prize, which was in 2002 after our September 11th coverage. Mm. I was merely the copy editor and AV Club editor. But I felt really strongly that it should be submitted. You know, and I said this about Weird Al Yankovic and how I think he should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I feel the same way about The Onion and a Pulitzer. I think that it would be a very, very smart move for the Pulitzers to consider something like that. It would certainly have people talking about the awards, and it also would sort of be a sincere commentary on the fact that this is that what they do is hard, and what they mm-hmm. do is commentary, and that what they do is
they do it at a very high level
and have been doing it at a very high level over the
for
course
a good long
of 23
time.
Yep. years. You know, I say this in partially in honor of The Onion's 1,000th issue. Mm-hmm. Which, as of this taping, I believe is just going live. Hmm. They've gathered an assortment of luminaries, including Tom Hanks, obviously, Paul Reiser. Mm-hmm. I'm going to mess up his name, but Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of the Republic of Georgia.
Now, where did was this an organic campaign, or did someone at The Onion?
I believe someone.
Because there's a Twitter campaign going around as well, right?
Right, with the hashtag Onion Pulitzer. Yeah. I think my guess is that they approached Tom Hanks's people and maybe had film crews going around trying to find Mikhail Saakashvili. I'm not sure that Mikhail Saakashvili was like Onion Pulitzer. That was the stupidest Saakashvili impression ever. He was like Apu. But anyway, what
I know a couple of actual Georgians. If you'd like me to come in and get one to come in and dub that for
and,
you,
yes, and do their Saakashvili impersonation. But what is making me happy is the fanfare surrounding my beloved Onion. So that brings us to the end of another episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Can you follow us on Twitter?
Oh my gosh! You know you can. You can follow all sorts of people on Twitter since we've had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different people on this very episode. And you can follow Linda Holmes and the Monkey C blog at NPR Monkey C, even though she has not been present in this discussion. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker. The first time I have ever spoken those words and not sung them. You can follow Tanya Ballard Brown at T double B. That's T D O U B L E. GB. You can follow Glenn Weldon at G-H Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You cannot follow Bob Mondello, who still types with an IBM Selectric. And you can follow me. Almost forgot myself. You can follow Stephen Thompson, your thankfully temporary host, at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. And you can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. His band, Hello Come In, provides our kicky in and out music. Also, please don't forget to like us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/PCHH. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank
Glad
you.
To do it.
And thank you all for listening.
Bye-bye.